This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services, Robin Dow Producing, and your email is talk@talklouisiana.org. And if you're so inclined, we always like to hear your voice at 877-217-5757. We're 150 days away from the governor's election as of today, 21 weeks from Saturday, and Governor John Bel Edwards will be in the House today. We have much to catch up with him about for his 86th Ask the Governor show. 2 o'clock's the show time, and we will talk with the governor about a legislative session that has largely not gone the way he wanted it to, but he has dealt with a very conservative legislature for 7.5 years now, and this is nothing new for him. We start our show with Kara St. Cyr. She is one of the primary anchors of Louisiana, the state we're in, LPB's signature show. It's been around for almost a half century, and Kara's been on the desk for the last 2.5 years. And there have been some extremely talented people through the years who have been at that desk, including Jeff Dewey, Robert Collins, some people I know well, Beth Courtney, of course. Started as a journalist of note with LPB and then ended up running the whole show for a generation. But Kara is only 26, but she's already worked at all three of the major network outlets here and for the last 2.5 years has been at LPB. Soon you'll have a new co-anchor, Andre Almoro, my good friend, I think is soon leaving, and we hope to talk with him on his way out the door. But had a long career in journalism, and that's the nature of the beast. You have to roll with the flow. You'll have to adjust to a new co-anchor.
I am going to have to adjust. But, I mean, I'm definitely going to miss him. I was really excited to work at LPB whenever I found out that Andre was going to be my co-anchor because I've been watching him since I was in middle school. So I was like, oh, goodness, this is so exciting.
Since you were in middle school.
Yeah.
And Andre and I went to school together, so there is a generational gap there, but you seem to have the requisite chemistry that is necessary. And you're 26 years old. Kara's from a generation that largely gets its news in ways that differently than I do. For example, here I have 2 newspapers that are actually printed. I bet you don't do that on a regular day, do you?
No.
No.
I get everything off my phone.
Everything off your phone.
Pretty much. I definitely look at newspapers online, so it's kind of the same thing, but I just, the paper, I can't do the paper. It's always better to look at it on my phone.
And you manage to stay abreast of what's going on in the state. I see stories on that show that I only have a cursory knowledge of, and it's because of Kara and Andre, they're staying on top of it. And of course, you truly like to give people something they don't see in other places.
Definitely, definitely. I guess the good thing about getting your news from your phone is you can also get different perspectives. And that also helps us, you know, stay up to date with what's going on. And sometimes you'll find out things that you can't see in newspapers or in different publications because people are just talking about it. And that's pretty much how we stay on top of things. Well, that's how I do. Andre uses the newspaper sometimes.
But for example, you get stuff off TikTok, right?
Yeah, I do get some things off TikTok. Whenever I was I did one story about the baby formula shortage that happened a while back, and I found a family and a woman that was, she kind of started her own baby formula business, going out and mailing it to different people that needed it all across the country, and I found her through TikTok. So yeah, TikTok can be pretty useful.
Well, Kara St. Cyr, if she stays in Baton Rouge, I'm sure she'll own the town, and it is her town. She's a Baton Rouge High graduate. 2014, right?
Yeah, 2014.
Manship School 2018.
Yep.
And has been doing this for a little while, and she's worked at WAFB, WBRZ, and WBLA. In fact, I think 2 stints at AFB, right?
Yeah, I did an internship there, and then I went back and did an independent study before I graduated.
And now is at LPB, and it's a great entity, as we know, for those of us who treasure public broadcasting. LPB has been the gold standard since 1976, and it's going strong. But one of the reasons why I invited her on the show today, a young woman, not much older than Kara, 31 years old, Caitlin Collins, from the University of Alabama. She was front and center last week when CNN held this town hall meeting in a room full of Donald Trump supporters with Donald Trump, who, as we know, manages these kinds of interviews like a professional wrestler. It's all bravado and largely untrue stuff, but he puts on a show. He's a great performer. And in order to combat that, you really have to stand tall and take on a force that is to be reckoned with. Do you think she did a good job?
I do. Given the circumstances, I think she did as well as anybody would be able to do in that situation. He's been known to interrupt reporters multiple times, speak over them, and I think that she did a pretty decent job. I do think there were some areas where she could have, you know, kept the interview from going on too long, but when you're in that situation, it's kind of difficult to gauge when you should interrupt the person you're interviewing, because you don't want to stop them from potentially making a point, but you also don't want it to go on too long, and you don't want them to, you know, confuse the people that are listening. So I think there are some places she could have improved, some places I really don't think there was much she could do.
Well, Donald Trump's not the easiest guy to interview, and I think Lawrence O'Donnell, unlike many others on MSNBC, he said she did a better job than he would have done. Because he's an unconventional interviewee, he doesn't play by the rules most people do. And I really think that the best person to interview Trump would have been a comedian, because a performer would be naturally at odds with another performer who plays the game in a different way. You got a traditional journalist asking conventional questions, and you got a guy totally off the rails who's going to say what he says and say it with conviction, and he's got a room full of people cheering him on. And it was not a fair fight, as we would say. But CNN got 3.3 million viewers that night, which is about five times what they normally get. And they're being criticized for this, but I think any network would have taken the opportunity to talk with Donald Trump. I didn't like the format, but Donald Trump's a person who can't be ignored. He is the former president, and he is the front runner for the Republican nomination. And right now, he's in front of everybody on the Democratic side who might be running for president, principally the guy who holds the job now, Joe Biden. And he did make some revelations. There's no doubt news was made on that show, so I can't fault CNN for actually doing the program.
No, I don't think you can. And I mean, the questions she asked, they were definitely necessary. And even if we didn't get the answers that maybe you would get from a conventional candidate, I still think it was necessary, because that is a politician's job. They're supposed to be held accountable with interviews and things like this.
And Trump knows his way around a television studio, and that's essentially what we were dealing with there. We were dealing with a performance artist who was on familiar terrain, and got a 31-year-old journalist who's going against a 77-year-old guy who's been before cameras now for 50 or 55 years. So it was somewhat of an unfair matchup, but Caitlin Collins did her best, and I think she did better than most would have done. There was a lot of prep work, but I wonder about the precedent for this. CNN has taken so much grief for doing it. I have a feeling that, Kara, it may not be replicated anytime soon.
That's hard to say.
But they did get ratings.
Yeah, ratings. And as we know, ratings don't lie.
Ratings. Bill Huey says she did a much better job than most could have with that monster Trump. This is Bill Huey. She never has tolerated his, and I can't repeat the word, even when a young reporter in the White House briefing room, and Trump clearly hates it. But Trump did approve, and he had the authority to do that. He did approve her as his questioner. And at one time, she did work for Tucker Carlson. So I think he pretty much knew what he was getting, and I think he would have rather had her than, say, somebody like Jon Stewart, who, as I said, would have gone off script and put him in a situation that he might not be as comfortable with.
Right. And like I said before, I do think she did a pretty decent job with trying to keep him on track, because, for instance, whenever they got to talking about the wall, he kept saying that he had completed hundreds of miles of wall, and she kept interrupting and saying, "Mr. President, you've only completed 52 miles." So, yep. I mean, there were some good things there.
Over and over.
Over and over.
And he revealed that he was not on board with Ukraine and the war with Russia, which was started by his friend Vladimir Putin. There were some revelations of note. He said that he was not inclined to oppose Kevin McCarthy for being a strict guardian of the debt ceiling, even though he acknowledged, Trump did, that that wasn't the case when he was president. So there were some revelations there that I think were noteworthy. And one thing we know, he hasn't changed a bit. A day after he is basically convicted in civil court of sexually assaulting a woman, he was making jokes about it and saying he never knew the woman. And Caitlin Collins, I thought, under the circumstances, held her own.
Yeah, she definitely did. That part in particular was interesting because the audience seemed like they were really, I mean, of course, this was Republicans that were in the audience, but it seemed like they were willing to support this the entire time. And I think that also contributed to some of the issues with the town hall was every time she tried to speak or every time he made a point and maybe she needed to ask another question, there was lots of cheering.
Well, congrats on your success, Kara St. Cyr. Hopefully this is the first of a few appearances with us. And we'll be back with Christine Yu. Her book is Up to Speed. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Christine Yu is our guest, an award-winning journalist whose work focuses on the intersection of sports, science, and women athletes. Her work has appeared in The Washington Post, Runner's World, many places. She lives in Brooklyn, and her book is Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. How can the latest science help women achieve their athletic potential? And as we know, women's athletics is now taking a life of its own. Look at the LSU women's basketball team, which is now the talk of Tigertown after winning the national championship. And women have the capacity to certainly achieve the same kinds of success as men do and in athletics. And Christine, you have made a career looking at this. And how do we get past the myths and gender biases that we have regarding female athletes?
Yeah, thanks, Jim, for having me. There are so many myths and gender biases, right, in terms of what people believe women's bodies are and are not capable of doing. And a lot of that misinformation, you know, persists because there hasn't been a lot of research done around female physiology, specifically as it relates to athletic training and sports performance. So we need more research.
Well, where are we now as far as understanding the fact that women have an enormous capacity to improve in athletics and they're achieving great things? And are there some sports, for example, in which women have the capacity, I think, at some point to outdo men?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I think the sports that folks are really honing in on with that question, right, what can women outperform men on, is in the endurance world, particularly when we look at ultra endurance events. So these super long, you know, running races, you know, folks are competing at 100, 200, 250 mile races. And in those instances, the gap between men's and women's performances is closing in, right? It's becoming a lot smaller. And in some cases, women are outperforming men. They are winning these races outright, especially at the longer end of those races.
You write that the idea that women are the weaker sex has long been deeply ingrained in Western cultures. Women were seen as the foil to men, the delicate, feeble-minded, and feminine counterparts to male virility, wisdom, and masculinity. And we know that's not the case, but these old myths and wives' tales, they're hard to get by sometimes, aren't they?
They absolutely are. And, you know, when we look at something like sports has always been this arena for men to compete, right? To display their masculinity, to show their strength. And that's why women were not allowed into that same field. They've been kept off the starting lines for so long. But because of that, it means that, you know, as I was alluding to earlier, it means that women haven't really had the chance to play sports until recently. And these myths continue to persist. It wasn't until the 2014 Winter Olympics that women were allowed to ski jump because the international, you know, the Olympic Committee and the folks in charge of the International Ski Federation thought that the impact on landing from those ski jumps would make the women's uterus burst. And that was the reason that they shouldn't do it.
Mm. What about diet? Through the years, men have been taught that diet is a great catalyst to not only being in shape, but to have endurance and strength. And women are now doing many of the same things, but is it different from a woman than it is for a man?
I think there are a couple of factors. I think one of the factors, you know, as you were saying, right, that men have seen diet and nutrition as this vehicle to help them, right, be fit, to perform well. Whereas women, yes, rationally there is that understanding, but they're also working against a lot of social cultural norms in terms of what women's bodies should look like, right? Like they should be thin, they should be lean, they should be feminine. And that at times can be at odds with what their bodies actually need if they want to perform well, right? If they want to compete at the top levels. So in that case, it leaves women, you know, oftentimes under fueling themselves, not eating enough food to support their bodies, you know, through the daily life, but also to support their training and exercise needs.
Well, it's a book that covers every facet of the female anatomy and how it applies to athletics. And of course, women have a cycle that men don't, and you go there. How is this a factor, if at all, when it comes to competing in athletics?
Absolutely. You know, I think I remember when I was in health class learning about my menstrual cycle, we only talked about it in, you know, its role to coordinate a woman's fertility, right? To coordinate the reproductive system. But the fact is that all of those hormones that are involved in that cycle actually have other jobs in the body that are really important. So everything from building and maintaining bone mass, to building and maintaining muscle, to cardiovascular health. And those all obviously have repercussions too in terms of one's fitness and one's ability to perform athletically. So we're starting to recognize that this is an important piece of a woman's physiology that we need to pay attention to outside of, right, just whether or not she can get pregnant.
The book is Up to Speed, Christine Yu, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. Hal in Monroe asks about supplements. Are there supplements specifically directed to women who are participating in athletic ventures?
There are definitely certain areas where, you know, women might experience some deficiencies. So, you know, areas in terms of like iron is a big one, because iron is so important in how the body carries oxygen, right, throughout the body to the muscles and everything. And so women can tend to be more iron deficient. And so, you know, an iron supplement may be something to discuss, right, with a sports nutritionist or with a doctor. Another area might be in terms of vitamin D and calcium, again, because bones are so important to everything that we do, but women might tend to be more deficient in those areas.
Another listener, Christine, asks about women living longer, and they do mm-hmm. by a pretty good margin over men, about 10% longer on the average. Does this mean that their athletic prowess can last longer than most men?
It's possible, right? I think in the past, we just haven't given women the opportunity to really stay active and to continue to perform after, you know, a certain period of time. You know, we always kind of think of midlife as this stage where, you know, that's your off ramp from physical activity. That's when you should stop doing stuff. But we haven't really just had the opportunity to try, right, to try to do more as we've lived longer. And I think we all know there are so many benefits to exercise, and that's equally important as we age, maybe even more important, right, to stay active and mobile as we age. So there's so much opportunity, I think, that, you know, we haven't even touched upon.
Do we pursue athletics from a female perspective differently in the United States and in other parts of the world? And also as far as ethnic backgrounds, are there more... For example, are there more Asian people who are distance runners than Caucasian? Is there a correlation on some of these matters?
That's a really good question. And I will be completely honest. I don't know, right? Like, I think that there could be, right? Because we see that, you know, there's a lot of runners from African nations that do really well in events like the marathon and longer distance running. But it's a question, is that just, you know, could that also be, you know, potential stereotype and just what we notice and pay attention to? Because we haven't actually maybe studied, right, the non-Western nations as much. We haven't really paid attention to what's going on there. It might be that that's just, you know, part and parcel with their culture. So, yes, you know, folks grow up running longer distances, or that's just what they do, right? But mm-hmm. I think that that's a very interesting question that, you know, we definitely need more information on.
Well, it's a book chock full of information that I've not seen in other places. Up to Speed, the Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes, from Christine Yu. Christine, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
And when Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. And when we return, open lines, we'll start with Gustavo after this. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 150 days remaining between now and Election Day. All the statewide offices on the ballot, October 14th, 21 weeks from Saturday. And only two incumbents in statewide offices are running for re-election. Billy Nungesser, Lieutenant Governor, who's being opposed by Albert Lee Guillory, our frequent guest. And Mike Strain, running for Agriculture Commissioner. I don't think Commissioner Strain at this point has an opponent, but the other races look to be competitive with more than a few combatants, including the race for governor. Today, Governor John Bel Edwards, who is a lame duck, dealing with a session that is not of his liking to this point, will be in-house to take your calls at 2 p.m. for Ask the Governor. And before we opine a bit about the governor's election, again, your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org, and I think we lost Gustavo during the break, but I always enjoy hearing from our friend in Goodwood. Today I was at Louie's, as I am most mornings, and Jimmy Weatherford, the proprietor and a fine underwriter for WRKF, was preparing meals, as was the staff there, for the LSU baseball team. The team's been in a bit of a slump, and they need some sustenance from Louie's to get back to the top of the game, and I mentioned that the football team has been getting orders from Louie's. Now, they have this state-of-the-art cafeteria over at LSU, but they still know the food is often better off-campus, as in really close to campus, on Lake Street. Louie's is preparing food for the football team, and usually the order is 115 box meals, 40 orders of three scrambled eggs, bacon, and pancakes, 30 orders of three eggs, scrambled bacon, and French toast, 20 eggs, bacon, cheese bagel, and potatoes on the side, 20 orders of those, and 25 three-egg scrambled chicken sausage grits with cheese. Well, today, Jimmy tells me the baseball team ordered this sausage, egg, cheese, and English muffin sandwich, two full pans, a sausage, egg, English muffin sandwich, one full pan, 60 strips of bacon, one half pan of scrambled eggs, hash browns, no onions, one full pan, two full pans of French toast, mixed fruit and bananas, two full pans, along with syrup, hot sauce, ketchup, plates, and serving utensils. So that was an order from Kayla Lawson, the Director of Performance Nutrition for Olympic Sports, the LSU Athletic Department. So they're eating well, and maybe the baseball team can beef up in the next few days and win another national championship. It's been a while. LSU's not won one since 2009, 14 years ago. Remember, they won five under Skip Bertman, one under Paul Maneri, and now Jay Johnson has had the number one team for most of the season, but the Tigers have been slumping a bit, and now they have dropped to number five in the nation. As mentioned, 150 days away from the governor's election, and this is an open seat, and it's not really a real well-known cast of characters as far as statewide recognition, and that's why some of these people have to really make a move in the next few weeks or it'll be too late. But a listener has noted, when this position has been open in the past, state lawmakers have actually done better at times than congressmen and former governors, and that was evident in 1995 when Mike Foster beat Buddy Romer. He beat Cleo Fields. Romer was former congressman, former governor. Cleo Fields was a sitting congressman. Mike Foster also had others in that race, as mentioned. One of the people was Phil Price, who ran a strong campaign, was with us a few days ago, and a respected lawyer. Melinda Schwagman was in there. She was the lieutenant governor, and Mary Landrieu ran a close third, and she might very well have won a runoff, but she didn't make it. She was edged out by Cleo Fields. She was the state treasurer at the time. And in 1987, it was not an open seat, but Edwin Edwards had had two trials in New Orleans, and he was wounded. And he was challenged by not one, not two, but three congressmen, and Buddy Romer, Bob Livingston, and Billy Tozan, as well as the Secretary of State, Jim Brown, and former Congressman Speedy Long. In 1987, just to show you how things have evolved, it is 36 years ago, and Buddy Romer, as remembered, won it without a runoff when Edwin Edwards pulled out, but Jim Brown was a popular candidate then, but he was in a crowded field. He's trying to gain traction. And he had my mentor, one of them, Jules Demacourt, do a spot for him. And I don't think something like this would fly today, but it is fun to go back in time. Here's a remembrance of Jules Demacourt doing a campaign spot for one Jim Brown in the year of 1987.
Two eyes to see what's true, two ears to hear it too, two feet and two hands. Now let's see where you stand. Got two hands, but only takes one to vote two. Be sure we've won. Take 2 feet to the polls. Here's how it goes. Black is beautiful, brown is too. Now, brother, sister, it's up to you. Jim, Jim, vote two for Jim. Brown, brown, all around town. Black is beautiful, brown is too. It's up to you, Jim Brown, number two. The man, you with the plan.
Well, Jim Brown got 9%. But these kinds of jingles, and we don't hear them much anymore, but Roy Fletcher directed Mike Foster to the mansion 8 years later, and Foster at that time was a 65-year-old, relatively unknown, multimillionaire businessman from Franklin. His grandfather had been governor of Louisiana a century earlier. But Mike Foster came out of the pack in 1995 and ended up winning, and he was a Democrat until he was 65, but became a Republican on qualifying day and ended up getting the conservative vote in Louisiana. And he portrayed himself as a every man kind of fellow, a welder, pro-life, pro-gun. And it worked. It worked. Roy Fletcher did a masterful job. But here is a sampling of the kind of message that then Senator Foster was providing to the listeners on radio stations across the great state of Louisiana.
From the carpenter to the accountant, our people are demanding change. No more king, scandal, or corruption, just a governor who can make us proud again. Mike Foster, a conservative.
All right, I think we're starting to lose our punch with this, so yeah, tone it down, please. But we get the idea. Mike Foster, 1995, and he was then reelected in 99. He beat Bill Jefferson in that race, and Foster won two relative landslides in his two ventures for governor of Louisiana. He then backed Bobby Jindal to be his replacement, and Jindal did make a runoff, but lost to Kathleen Blanco in the year of 2003. And that was an open seat and had an all-star list of candidates. Blanco was lieutenant governor. Richard Iyube was in the race. He was attorney general. Buddy Leach, former congressman, was in that race. Randy Ewing, highly respected lawmaker from North Louisiana, Quitman, Louisiana. He was in the race, as was Hunt Downer, another lawmaker with some impressive credentials. But ultimately, it was Blanco and Jindal in a runoff, and Blanco came from behind and ended up winning 52-48%. Jindal won the next two times out, and he hasn't been heard from much since he had a disastrous run for president. In 2016, the year that gave us Donald John Trump, and Jindal did not receive one delegate in his quest to become leader of the free world. What will happen come October 14th? It remains to be seen, but right now, Jeff Landry is the favorite. Favorites often fade in the stretch, but Jeff Landry may end up being the Secretariat of 2023. He may end up winning wire to wire, and he, at this time, has a field that is to his liking. Sean Wilson is the likely runoff candidate if the election were today, and Sean Wilson is a Democrat in a red state. There are no statewide elected Democrats other than John Bel Edwards, and Sean Wilson is swimming upstream when it comes to trying to win a race in Louisiana. And Jeff Landry has some Republican company, but to this point, it's not the kind of field that would seem possible to have two Republicans in a runoff. If that were the case, I think it would be a case in which Landry would have to fight for his life to win, but if he gets Sean Wilson, he's probably going to win the election. And Jeffrey Martin Landry, former congressman and now two-term attorney general, is at this point, 150 days out, the likely victor in the governor's race. So we will see, and I'm sure many of the Republicans will slam away at Landry. Sean Wilson will not. He will stay above the fray until the runoff, and then all the Republicans who slam Landry will probably be endorsing him, with maybe one or two exceptions, but it's quite likely he'll get all of their endorsements if that's the way it plays out. But the other candidates can't be neglected. There are some substantial people in the race, including Stephen Wagespack, who led LABI for a decade and worked closely with former Governor Jindal. There's John Schroeder, state treasurer, former state lawmaker, elected to the Louisiana House at the same time as John Bel Edwards, so he's now been in public life for 16 years. And then there's Richard Nelson, who is a brilliant young man who's been the top of his class in every institution he's attended. Bright fellow, but whether he can come out of the pack and emerge victorious, that would seem to be a long shot. Sharon Hewitt, who is the only female of note in the race, she also is running and is from the same neck of the woods as Representative Nelson, Senator Hewitt is. And then there's Hunter Lundy, who is an exotic candidate running as an independent. He will be with us this Friday, and he is a guy who has a message and I think is now positioned to gain some traction as an independent. But as we know, independents often fade in the stretch. But we'll talk with him. And I remember years ago when he was running against Chris John, he almost got elected to Congress, but that was a long time ago. And we'll talk more about the governor's election after this quick timeout on Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org. As mentioned, Governor Edwards today at 2 o'clock, and we will talk with him about what this squabble over the debt limit will mean if things go awry between the president and the Speaker of the House in Washington. President Biden and congressional leaders from both parties emerged from a White House meeting yesterday, offering some glimmer of hope about eventually reaching a deal to raise the nation's borrowing limit, even as they conceded they were still far from averting a default that could come as soon as June 1st, which is 15 days away. And with time dwindling to strike a compromise that could make it through Congress in time to avoid an economic catastrophe, Biden said he would cut short a diplomatic trip to Asia to be on hand for a potential breakthrough. And Speaker McCarthy, the Baptist from Bakersfield, says it's possible that such a deal could materialize within days. And the president agreed to dispatch his top advisors for stepped-up negotiations with McCarthy, whose number two guy is Steve Scalise. And today, one of our guests was slated to be the Republican of note, Rob Manus, and the colonel believes that Scalise is too liberal. But he did say he voted for him, and Steve Scalise may very well be Speaker of the House. He has been a masterful political operative on Capitol Hill, and we commend him for recovering from a near-fatal gun wound in 2017. It's been 6 years, and Scalise is, he's at the precipice of power. So we shall see. 877-217-5757, and we are going to spend a few minutes with none other than Jim Caldwell, the marketing director for the Baton Rouge Airport. And Jim, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Well, Jim, we've got this big flight starting June 1st, the same day the debt limit is supposedly going to go up, up, and away, or not at all, whatever, but it's to Washington, D.C., so people can get a front row seat, right?
That's literally right. Nonstop, departs at 5:42 a.m. The return is 9:30 p.m., so you can certainly get a full day of business in or leisure vacation in. Those are good times they gave us.
So it's a one flight a day thing, right?
Yes. Initially, American Airlines, has committed one nonstop round trip flight using the Embraer 175 aircraft, which is a larger regional jet with first and coach seating, a really comfortable aircraft. The pitch and coach and width, seat width, is comparable to what you get on mainline aircraft. So we were really happy to get that particular aircraft.
And so you arrive in Washington at approximately what time?
9:26 a.m.
9:26 Washington time, 8:26 Baton Rouge time. So you can basically spend the whole day there, and you come back at what time?
The return is 9:30 p.m. 7:52 p.m. It arrives at 9:30 p.m. And it, works well for, a business traveler, or if someone wants to go up on a Friday or a Saturday for a long weekend, it allows them to get full days enjoying Washington.
Well, it's a great place to travel, and it is, when it comes to politics, the center of the universe. And I would imagine part of the politicos who are in Baton Rouge will take advantage of this. And some would, in fact, a listener already asked me, why hasn't this been done before? Because it's, I think you're going to get some traction on this, Jim.
I think so, too. We've been working on it for over 10 years. We came close not too long after U.S. Airways added nonstop service to their Charlotte hub, and then subsequently American and U.S. Airways merged, and the Department of Justice required that they divest some of the slots in Washington since it's a slot-controlled airport, which kind of knocked us back down the list again because they had to actually cut service. But we've worked our way back up and kind of had a good community effort and have made it happen now. So we did have service to Washington on Delta, I think it was 2007, 2008 period. It was before I came. It was eventually canceled, but we've got it now, and it's even better because it's not a 50-seat aircraft. It's a larger regional jet. It's two Americans hub in Washington National, which means obviously we want the majority of the people to be going to Washington to support that part of the service, but the hub allows people to connect to other cities, real good connections, along the East Coast, Northeast, so that makes it less of a challenge when you're totally dependent on people just going to Washington.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org to engage Jim Caldwell, marketing director for the Baton Rouge Airport. And Jim, the Baton Rouge Airport, like others, suffered a severe downturn with COVID. The comeback for those of us who travel out of your airport is noticeable. How substantial has it been? Do you have numbers to verify that?
We like virtually every airport, had our numbers, plummet in 2020. But we're making a strong comeback. The industry is, overall, big challenges, as many have probably read, the pilot shortage and even shortages in other areas, even at the bigger, more congested airports. Control tower personnel has become even an issue, but we've come back well. We so far this year we're running about 92% of 2019, and 2019 is kind of the benchmark, the last pre-COVID year, and for us it was a 10-year record in passenger volume. So if we get back to 2019, we're doing well. And the big thing is just getting the seating capacity, the number of airline seats in the market, comparable to 2019, because you've done it with seats, you can't get the numbers. But we, for the second half of this year, we're going to be within 2% of the 2019 seating capacity. And our load factors are really strong now, much better than 2019. Mm-hmm. They were about 78% then. We're about 84% now. So put those two factors together, and we should come very close to 2019, if not exceed it, in the second half of this year.
Listener, this is Tom on Bluebonnet asks, how many cities do you fly directly to out of Baton Rouge?
Well, nonstops are Delta to Atlanta, and by the way, they're flying all mainline Boeing 717s, well over 100 seats.
And several times a day, too.
Four times a day, yes. So, and it's kind of indicative of what's happened. Our seating capacity is up on less frequency because of up gauges, you know, larger aircraft. American has service to their two largest hubs, Dallas going west, Charlotte in the east, and, of course, the Washington starting June 1st. And United has service to one of their largest hubs, Houston Intercontinental.
And, of course, once you hit one of those spots, you're on your way to wherever you want to go. And when you factor in the travel time to New Orleans, for those who prefer a more direct flight availability, it's quite often a wash. It may seem like you're getting there faster, but you're probably not, and you have to drive. And I don't think you charge quite as much for parking as you do as they do in New Orleans. But
we don't, and ours is terminal front. You don't have to ride a bus or a van and have that additional time for that and longer lines. It's terminal front parking. You get through security fast, and you know, all that combined with the drive, you're right, means that even with a connection, the total elapsed time is competitive out of here, and it's just a lot easier.
And Jim, you've been there for a few years now.
I have. 14 years now.
14 years. My, how time flies. Jim Caldwell.
It does.
Marketing director for the Baton Rouge Airport. Remember when it was called Ryan Field? We'll take a few calls. Robin says some folks want to talk with Jim, but please be concise. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, good morning, Jim. What's it like about to fly through these thunderstorms? I know the weather seems to have gotten a lot more severe, and flights depend on being safe, having safe weather to fly in. Thank you.
Well, aircraft have advanced radar. Their screens can show them exactly where storms are, the density, severity of it. So they typically fly around thunderstorms. The problem is if the thunderstorm is directly over the airport they're trying to land to, then in cases like that, they sometimes, you know, have to just wait it out, or if it doesn't clear and it's still too severe, they'll divert to their alternate airport.
And because of climate change, I don't think there's much doubt there is more turbulence than there has been in the past, but it's amazing how these veteran passengers and the crew, they don't blink an eye. It's just like you're you're jumping all over the place, but it's another day at the office. Mitchell at Sherwood.
Oh, yeah.
Mitchell, you're on. Quickly, Mitchell.
Hey, good morning. I got another question to ask about. I got my daughter that lives in Glen Oaks and my son, and when the airplanes are passing over their houses, they shake them, and they done mess their windows and coming all out of hinges. What are the airports going to do about that?
Well, if you live close to an airport, anywhere in the world, you're going to have some of those issues, but those planes are powerful vehicles, aren't they?
Yeah, and one thing today, the aircraft are much quieter than they were in past years. It's the quietest, you know, the Stage 3 aircraft that have ever flown into BTR. Now, that would be something to address with the FAA. They do the noise program, sound program, which we had, and they come in and do measurements, contours of the sound within certain radius of the airport, and our program's complete. They dealt with all the airports that fell within the radius of you know, doing soundproofing, things with the windows.
We do have to roll, but Jim Caldwell, always a pleasure. Keep up your good work at the Baton Rouge Airport. Signature support for our show is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. For Robin Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Stay tuned.